Views expressed on the following show are not necessarily those of the guest, host, or SaratogaBroadcasting.com. Talk of the Town is a production of Saratoga Broadcasting Incorporated. And now the host of Talk of the Town, Lynn Goodness and Rick Thompson.
Well, I want to welcome everybody to Talk of the Town. And your host, Rick Thompson. Lynn Goodness won't be here today. He's in Syracuse, New York with his family, and they're going to their granddaughter's recital this morning. So it'll be myself and our guest, Patrick Mayer from Thailand, who will be calling in very shortly so we can do our live interview. How are you?
Yeah. Everything's great. I've been sitting here listening to your music, and it's relaxing.
Yeah, it is. 80s music is relaxing. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me out.
That's okay. Back again from Thailand. And how's everything over there?
Yeah, it's hot. Things are hot. The rainy season's rolling in, so it's nice that to get into monsoons to cool things off.
Boy, I wish we were hot over here. Spring isn't sprung. I tell you, we're having a tough time.
It's still cold there, then.
Oh, yeah. We've had two beautiful days about 3 weeks apart, and then in between we've had 50-degree weather and rain, and I don't know. Just can't wait for the warm weather to get here, you know?
Yeah, I know. We're spoiled with sunshine here all the time, so I forget what it feels like to be back there.
Well, you're a lucky guy, let me tell you that. Well, I want to thank you for being here. You were on the last time, and we did have some technical difficulties, but we wanted to kind of expand our interview a little bit with some different areas to go off into. And I think we have to start in the beginning, as we do with all our guests. We like to ask them, you know, are you from Thailand? How did you get started? Where you grew up? And things like that. So if you don't mind, I'd like to go back and ask you, number one, were you brought up in Thailand?
No, I was brought up, I grew up in East Grand Rapids, Michigan.
You did, okay. I kind of knew that, but we always ask our guests that, so. And tell us a little bit about you growing up. Your father was a storyteller and...
Yeah, my dad was a storyteller. He liked to sit around and tell stories a lot. And he was a successful pediatric allergist. So we had financially had a comfortable life. And we came from a big Catholic family of three brothers and three sisters. You know, our house is very active and chaotic. I kind of like to live a very quiet life. So at that time for me, you know, I just kind of pulled away and spent a lot of time in my room alone, just all the activity all the time. But, you know, growing up was, my mother's was the child of an alcoholic, and her father was a severe alcoholic. So she just had a hard time with all, trying to raise all seven children.
Sure. Well, that's quite a family. But yeah. I know myself, see, I'm the opposite of you. I like chaos.
Oh, you do.
Yeah, I have a large family. I'm one of three brothers, but I have a large extended family with aunts and cousins and that. And my happiest times was getting together holiday time and having 30 or 40 family members and kids and now grandkids and whatever running around. And I kind of like that. But
I've read once some people get energy from that. For me, it's taxing, and it makes me kind of tired with all the stimulation.
Oh, sure. Well, I have a brother-in-law like that. He's very creative, and right now, I mean, you know, he's all in his 50s, but he designs outdoor equipment. He lives in Colorado, and he designs backpacks for companies and different outdoor equipment. Things, and he's the same way you are. He likes to be alone. He likes quiet. He's very creative, like you are. And I think that's the general mode of creative people. They like solitude. They create that way. And it's you know, your dad made a rule in your house and about writing. What was that?
Yeah, well, when I was about 8 or 9, he made a rule that we had to write a page a day, and he gave us each a notebook, and so I started writing a page a day. I think I was the only child who actually did that in the family, who actually completed it, but I was angry about that, and so I started writing stories about motorcycle jumpers, because Evel Knievel was very popular then, and we loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a story about called the, I was, since I was angry at him, I wanted to get at, back at him, so I wrote a story about the Butt family, with B-U-T-T.
Yeah.
And they were all motorcycle jumpers. And my dad never got angry. And he complimented me on this story. And every day there was a new page of the story of this family, and a guy would die, and a new person from the family would jump motorbikes. And so, you know, he really encouraged me that way. And at a young age, he saw that I had a talent for telling stories.
So it wasn't the fact that that you thought you were getting back at him. It was his feeling that he just wanted you to be creative in writing. And you're the one that thought that you were getting back at him when all the time.
Right.
That's interesting.
And I guess at 8, when I could link, I had a beginning, kind of a storyline, and then a conclusion to the story. Yeah, some of those things, I think writing is a lot like music. It's kind of some kids at a young age kind of had a gift for storytelling.
Oh, sure. Well, anything like that. I mean, I think writing books is like mastering a musical a piece of music equipment. I mean, you know, not everyone can do it, not everyone has the talent, and I think, you know, if you do have the talent, you're an extraordinary person, because it's just something that's very important in life, and I think it helps open up your scope to everything in life. I mean, you can see a picture that a lot of other people can't see because of that.
Right.
Now, you went to boarding school. Did you go to Catholic school in the beginning?
I was pulled out. My dad pulled me out in the fourth grade. He pulled me out of public school and sent me to Catholic school for a year, where I served as an altar boy. And actually, I functioned well when there was a lot of structure around me, because our home was so unstructured and chaotic that I couldn't structure myself. And mm-hmm. So when I went off to Catholic school, I did. Actually, my grades were pretty good. But after a year, I begged him and pleaded to go back to public school, because that's where all my friends were.
Sure.
So I was sent back to public school then.
And from there, you after you graduated from high school, you graced our lovely city here in Saratoga Springs.
Yeah, well, before that, then I was sent off to the Hill School, to a boarding school.
Right, okay.
But before that. But yeah, then I went off to Skidmore at Saratoga Springs.
And did you enjoy your time in Skidmore? I mean, as far as the city goes.
I love the city. But for me, you know, I was still very much a Midwestern boy at heart.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to Skidmore, you had a lot of wealthy East Coast people.
Sure.
And it was a much different culture than the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And that was difficult for me.
And I felt
like an outsider.
Yeah, well, a lot of people do, actually, even today. But
they do.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I don't want to generalize. Saratoga is a beautiful city. There's a lot of wealth here, but yet, you know, the city's grown since when you were here in the '80s. I think just. When you had left, you know, the city was starting to get larger and more development and stuff.
Right.
And more out-of-town people were moving into Saratoga. And it just changed the ambiance of the city from it was always known as the city in the country. And now it's just getting to be a large city. So how was your experience at Skidmore?
Yeah, my experience was... you know, I played ice hockey there, and I was a good player. I made the varsity team and played on the second line. But I, you know, I had a hard time, and I didn't do well academically. And I ended up, after that first year, leaving with a 1.33 grade point average.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and I was pretty much, asked to leave the school because of an incident in one of the dorm rooms where we threw a chair out of a picture window.
So you were here to have fun.
Yeah, maybe, but I regret those things. I mean, if I could take that back, I would take that back. And it was certainly disgraceful for my family and my father that I had done something like that.
Yeah, we always go back and look at things that we could have done differently. But
yeah.
Was your time in Skidmore, do you think, the reason you didn't do well in school because of what we had just talked about, living in Saratoga Springs and feeling the way you did because being from the Midwest? Do you think that was why you didn't do well in school, or was it just the atmosphere that you didn't like?
No, I loved it, and I regretted leaving. I guess, you know, when I got there, I remember they were giving out school IDs, and they put a gold bar on your ID if you were 21, and they mistakenly put, or it was 19 that I think they drink. They mistakenly put a gold bar on my ID when I was a freshman, and I wasn't of drinking age.
Oh wow!
And so that opened up for me the whole nightlife, where I could go out all the time and have an ID and get into the bars.
Sure. And there's
and
a
so
lot
that
of
added that added to it. To it as well. And
yeah,
I just got into having fun. And yeah. Life was just a party, and my father paid for the whole thing, so I didn't take it seriously.
Sure. And this is a party town. I mean, there's a
yeah.
Caroline Street.
So it's still a party town back there.
Yeah. But you did get, you said you finished with a 1.33 grade average, but you did get an A- in creative writing course.
Yeah, that's right. And I wrote I remember one paper I wrote about my family. It was supposed to, you know, it's a creative piece, but I wrote a paper about my mother being an alcoholic, dying, and my father getting, I think I said he was in an accident and died. And this horrible story about my life. And I got an A on the paper, and the professor wrote a note on it, and he said, you know, I'm so sorry to hear about your loss. But it was the paper was it was a complete lie. And I had felt like I had cheated, so I never went up to him and said, you know, it's not true. I just kind of left the class. But it was creative writing, so I guess it wasn't. I look back now thinking, why did I feel that? But, yeah, I felt like I had cheated on the paper.
Sure. Well, you were writing a piece of fiction. And,
yeah.
And
realistic fiction. I like realistic fiction.
Sure,
like playing songs is a realistic
sure. Well, that's interesting. Now, in fact, are any of your parents still alive? Or
no, they both passed away. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what did you do after Skidmore?
After Skidmore, I went. I spent a couple summers in Alaska, actually working before I transferred. I transferred to Albion College, a college in Michigan. But I spent right after Skidmore, I went up to Alaska to work on a commercial fishing boat in Bristol Bay.
And what was that like? I mean, what's everybody thinks Alaska is kind of like the North Pole. And cold and freezing.
I mean, by far, I think one of the most beautiful places I've ever been in my life.
Really?
That's for sure.
That's amazing.
And that was, that's over 20 years ago now, or 20 years ago almost.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I ended up working on a couple fishing boats, and one of them was my skipper was a fanatical born-again Christian who would scream and yell at us all day, and eventually pulled out a knife on the crew, and I ended up quitting on that. Quitting that boat and moving on, but I made a lot of money up there, and it was a great adventure and a great experience. And I became addicted to adventure like that.
Really? Now, see, I'll tell you something that you could probably kick yourself if you had stayed on that fishing boat. You could probably be on a reality TV show here.
Oh, right. I think that's a crab show, isn't it? Alaskan Kid Crab.
Yeah. Alaskan. It may be a crab show. I don't watch it, but I know
it's crazy. Crazy, and my foot got caught in the net at one point. I was hanging over the boat.
Oh gosh!
And they back, you know, they put the engines back and reversed it, and I didn't fall over. But if you fall in the water there, you're pretty much done.
Really?
And I've got a fear of water as well. But it was a great experience.
Great experience. In '88, you got within 3 credits of finishing college, and you dropped out, and you moved out west. Here,
I moved out west.
In the U.S., out west.
Yeah.
And what was that what was that experience like?
Well, in my last year of college, I started writing a screenplay, and I started, you know, really actively writing. And so I wrote a screenplay called The City Slick Kid about a guy who goes up to Alaska and goes on this big adventure. And so I stayed in L.A. for about 3 years writing screenplays, and I got a literary agent for that script, but it never sold. And that was tough. You know, that's a tough business out there.
Oh, sure.
And I decided that, you know, I might never make it. I said I could be here and just, you know, I see so many people in Los Angeles kind of wasting their lives away hoping for hanging on to that dream of some type of making it out there. And then my father passed away, and I decided to go back to Michigan for a while.
So that's I think if you pin your hopes on making it out in Hollywood or L.A., you either have to have an extreme amount of luck or you have to know somebody that will introduce you into the right circles, because
right.
There are so many people out there trying to buy for any kind of a position in screenwriting or producing or acting in that. It's kind of a bizarre place out there.
It's bizarre. The thing is, it's really kind of the opposite of Saratoga, where, like, I was at Skidmore, and you'd have, like, third-generational and fourth-generational money, right, where it's kind of you have this, you know, that's how you gain your status, and mm-hmm. it's like an inherent status. But out in Los Angeles, you can just be anybody, and everyone's acting like they're really important.
Well, exactly, and that's exactly what it is. They're acting.
No, yeah, I agree.
It's very hard to tell who's real and who's acting out there. It's unreal. But
I couldn't see myself staying there for a long time.
No.
And so I was happy in the end. I'm happy I didn't stay there. I'm happy to have left.
Well, I mean, knowing your history that we're going to get into now, I think you made a wise decision in leaving there. I mean, instead of trying to stick it out and get lucky.
Yeah, and at the time I was working in a psychiatric facility at night and a locked facility, and that was really an interesting experience. But then I thought, you know, how long am I just kind of drift along here in life? And I saw people in their 40s and 50s who just had, you know, menial jobs mm-hmm. who were still trying to break into the business, and I thought, well, I've had enough of this.
Oh, my gosh, yeah, that's, and like we said, unfortunately, that's what happens out there. I mean, you get stuck in a rut, then you become a certain age that you really can't move on, and you know, it's a just a crazy thing. So you finished your education, you moved back to Michigan to help your mom, and you got a teaching credential.
Yeah, I went back, got a teacher credential, and they got a master's in anthropology as well.
Mm-hmm. And you really scored really well. So it's not that you couldn't do it; it's that you had to put your mind to do it.
No, yeah, and I ended up with like a 3.88, and you know, I had some regret then of not appreciating what my father had done for me in terms of paying for my education, and then when I was paying for it for myself, you know, it was a whole different story, because my mother cut me off. She cut me off. You know, I had said, oh, I need some money or something, and she said, this is the end of the party's over. There's going to be no more money.
Sure.
My dad would help me out. I could always call him and he'd help me out, but she wouldn't.
Well, let me ask you a question. If do you think it's better, I mean, going through your experience and knowing probably kids that went to college, do you think it's better to take time off between high school and college and get a little experience? Not an awful long time, but that maybe 2 years or so to get some experience in life so that when you go to college, you kind of appreciate it a little more? Or do you...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, as a teacher, I can see students that would benefit. Other kids are ready for it. For me, I should have taken a couple years off and done something else, and mm-hmm. then I would have been ready for it. But I agree, you know, some kids aren't ready for it.
Sure. And some kids just take it as an extension of high school.
And it becomes also can be a party time. Like, oh, I got some freedom. I can just go have fun. When it's not, I mean, looking back, I wish I had been more serious about my schooling.
Well, like you said, I think maybe, like me, you were a candidate of probably taking a year or so off to experience some things and then get back to college and kind of know what it's like out in the world and maybe get your mind in focus, you know.
Yeah.
So you finished your education. You headed off to Korea.
Yeah, I went off to Korea, and I had accumulated a lot of debt in America, like a lot of people. I had $30,000 of credit card debt, and I just couldn't get ahead in the United States. So I took a job in Korea in Busan, South Korea, teaching English at what they call a Hogwan. It's kind of like a language institute. But it paid good money, and that's where I started in Korea. And the minute I got off that boat, I remember I got off the airplane, and I said, you know, this is it. I'm not going to leave. I love it. From the day I stepped foot in Asia, I really loved it.
And the people were very welcoming?
Korea's a little, you know, more stone-faced culture. They're, you know, it's a little more, they don't smile a lot like the Thais, but, you know, they were, everyone was very nice to me. I can't complain.
Okay. And, you know, I feel sorry with the current conditions over there right now. It's got to be harrowing for South Koreans with what's going on.
Oh, with North. But that, you know, that's that. Even when we were there, they were always talking about the North, and you'd have air raid sirens.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It's always going on, and the North has always had this rhetoric, and it's always like that. And I remember the air raid sirens went off, and they have 16s flying through the sky, and I was panicking, and the Koreans were just laughing, and they just said, "Oh, just forget it."
You know, cultures are funny, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, when we grow up here, we take for granted so many things, and then you get into a situation like that, you're scared to death, and they're laughing.
Yeah, I won't even. I mean, they would laugh about North Korea because North Korea can't even produce a bicycle. I mean,
right.
They're not manufacturing anything. So I think the threat overestimates.
Going over there with the debt, and you fell into a relationship with a Korean woman. Who was the daughter of a government official.
Yeah.
Did you think things were getting better for you over there? I mean, obviously you had a job.
Yeah, I had a good job and making good money. And I almost doubled my salary by private teaching because there's so many. Where I was in Busan, I mean, I spent 3 weeks there before I saw another foreigner. So, I mean, I had people lined up to want me to teach them privately, which you could get paid anywhere from like $60 to $100 an hour for that.
Oh, my.
I'd work all day and come home and private teach for a couple hours. So my pocket was always stuffed with money.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
You know, the next the thing I want to ask you, I got to tell you a funny story about my father. Was in the service right after World War II and just in the beginning of Korea, but he was stationed in Bermuda. And the GIs could not date girls, native Bermuda girls. That was a no-no. Now, it wasn't the Army's rule. It was Bermuda's rule. Now, of course, he did, you know, like all GIs, he did have a Bermuda girlfriend, but that was cut off real quick.
Right.
And the same kind of thing happened to you, didn't it?
Yeah, well, kind of. I mean, at that time, I don't know what it's like now, but 20 years ago in Korea, or 17 years ago, whatever it was, they frowned upon Korean girls dating Western men. The Koreans did. And I think another reason for that is, you know, in Korea they prefer sons, and so they abort a lot of the female fetuses.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's 52% men, 48% women. And you'd be surprised at that 4% difference of how fewer women there are. And so many men are looking for marriage. And so when I'd go out, I remember walking with a girl down the street, and I'd take so many elbows in the shoulder, so many shoulder-to-shoulder people would bump into me that they really didn't like to see a Western man with a Korean woman.
Do you think some of that had to do with the war, with a lot of GIs maybe, you know, dating Korean prostitutes or single women
and
having children?
Well, there was stereotype that Westerners would date prostitutes, and so a lot of the girls were embarrassed to be seen with you in public because of that stigma.
Hmm. And how did the you said that the internet help change that perspective?
I would think that just the world seems to be getting smaller, right? And I've talked to some friends back there now, and they said, no, it's not nearly as bad as it used to be. So I just think all that, you know, I was there right when the internet revolution was just beginning. I mean, people didn't have emails yet. That was before Clinton's second term.
Mm-hmm.
And so the world seems to have gotten much smaller now.
Oh, yeah, it has. I mean, especially I'm talking to you from Thailand, and I have Skype. I can talk with my cousin in Italy a couple times a month. So,
right.
mean, in that respect, and you're looking at each other, so it's all, you know, I mean, you feel like you're in the other room, so it is getting smaller.
And with all, like, a Facebook, and people can share their world, and, you know, whereas before, I think, they just saw things through movies.
Sure. And that's, like we talked about Los Angeles, I mean, the things they see in the movies aren't true half the time, so, you know,
Yeah. They
get another outlook. So after Korea, what made you move to Japan?
Well, I had been in Korea for a while, and then I ended that relationship was put to an end because my girlfriend's father found out about us, and then she couldn't see me anymore. And then after that happened, I decided that I'd look for a job in Japan. And so one weekend, there's a hydroplane that runs from Busan, Korea, over to Fukuoka, Japan. And one weekend, I took that hydroplane over with my resume and with some paperwork that I had of, you know, my teaching license and things. And I spent a weekend walking in the streets of Fukuoka looking for work.
Now, did you know the Japanese language when you went over there?
No, I couldn't speak any Japanese.
No Japanese.
So
you decided basically that, I mean, even though you like Korea, there wasn't a future there because obviously you couldn't go out with Korean girls.
Well, you could, but the money was also better in Japan.
Okay.
And I had talked to people, go to Japan, it's much nicer, and they like, the Japanese like Americans a lot more.
Yeah.
They were very friendly to Americans.
All right, so you took that week trip there, and and you walked around a lot.
Yeah.
And I see you got a big blister on your foot from walking so much.
I walked and walked and walked. My feet were aching. I couldn't find a job. And then I sat down in a park to take my shoe off to look at this big blister I had. And sitting across from me was another foreigner, and we struck up a conversation. And it turned out he was a head teacher at a language school. And that a miracle of it all was that he ended up getting me a job at his school. So about 2 weeks after that, I was flying to Japan to start my new job.
Now, do you think that because you were a private teacher, that helped you get a job quicker than if you had just gone to Japan and were, you know, a regular classroom teacher?
Oh, at that time, yeah. Because I work in international schools now, which is a whole different job market than the language arts or the language schools, but that was really during the golden era of language school teaching in Korea and Japan, and that's fallen out now.
Okay.
But there was a lot of opportunity back then for just, you didn't even need a teaching license back then. You could go with just a college degree, you could go work at one of these language schools and make 3,000 to 4,000 U.S. a month tax free with a free apartment,
mm-hmm.
and then you could make a lot more private teaching as well after work.
That's great. I mean, it seems like a wonderful field that you were in, seeing that you could go from the day job and do some private work at night and make some decent money.
Yeah, and you could put away, 3,000 U.S. a month.
Sure.
Yeah, it was great. And you ride a bicycle, and it was a great life of freedom, I found.
Yeah, and everything was right in your area, correct? You didn't have to go too far to experience the parks and nature, and you could.
Yeah, and all that. And the other thing I liked is you're so far removed from the norms of society as a foreigner that I didn't feel any social pressure at all, you know, to have a car or, you know, do certain things or have certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was a foreigner living over there, I could just kind of have my own world.
And you met a Japanese and fell in love?
We spent about three. I was in Hiroshima first, but then I moved down to Kokura, where I met a woman named Tomoko, and we spent about 3 years together. But it wasn't the healthiest of relationships. I mean, it was a really up and down, a lot of bad fighting, and a lot of real intense makeup time. But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And eventually I left that situation.
Okay. Well, that's a smart move. And in 2000, you made a trip to Thailand.
I came down to Thailand, Laos, and Burma, and yeah, I love the region. When I came down to Southeast Asia, I just fell in love with it right away.
And you decided that's where you wanted to spend the bulk of your life was in that area.
Yeah, well, I guess when I came down here, that, you know, Japan is silent. When you get on a train there, it's completely silent and no one's talking. And when you go out, everything's really quiet there. And when I came down to this part of the world, you know, there's cafes with music, people are laughing. You know, Thailand's the land of smiles. You know, if they're embarrassed, they smile. If they're shy, they smile. It's you know, such a great atmosphere that I thought, gosh, you know, this is where I want to live. So I started looking for work down here, but that was a little bit difficult, and I had a little bit of a hard time landing a job at first.
Well, my impression of Thailand, and I got this from you the last time, or we talked about this, is entirely different than what Thailand really is. I expected it to be all jungle, a non-friendly place.
I
know, because my broadcasting partner and a good friend of mine did R&R in the Vietnam War in Thailand, and he said it was one of the most beautiful places he's ever been to.
Oh, yeah. Great.
And then from talking to you, I learned that it was such a beautiful place, and, you know, it was just the opposite of what I was thinking. Why I thought that, I have no clue.
And the tourists, I mean, their tourist industry here is just booming. It's just everyone's wanting to come to Thailand. And whenever someone comes here, they always want to come back. People I work with who quit, they always want to come back because it's such a comfortable life here.
I think I'd probably like to try it someday. There are two places, now this will be three, that I want to go. I'd like to go to Italy and see my family over there. And I always wanted to go, into Czechoslovakia and see some of the big cities over there. And now, after talking to you, I wanted to go see Thailand.
Yeah, well, come over. We can spend some time together. I'll show you around.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Have a few drinks.
Really,
yeah, that's great.
Yeah. And you took a job at an international school there.
Yeah, oh, yeah. So when I really wanted to have a family is one of the things. And then I wanted to get into really regular like K-12 teaching, and so I took a job at a Sikh school here, a Sikh international school and I was at the time with the exchange rate. I mean, I was making hardly anything. They gave me a free room and free food. Plus, I think it was I forget the salary was maybe $400 a month or something. It was hardly anything.
And
we had prayers every morning. It was a real religious atmosphere, and I mean, the Sikhs were great, they were nice, but it wasn't organized, and it turned out that it wasn't really where I wanted to be.
Sure. So what did you do?
I got married
here.
Eventually I got married here. After I ended up, you know, looking around for other work, and I found other work, and then I met my wife here almost right away. I think on the third day I was here, I met my wife. And then, we ended up getting married.
Meant to be. And you have two kids.
Yeah, we've got two kids, and we've got a house, and I've got a good job today. And, I'm doing much better now than I ever did in Japan and Korea. So
now, do you have two children? With your two children, a boy and a girl, or two boys?
Yeah, I got a boy, Seamus, and my daughter, Fiona. And
so you got, you have what they call a perfect family. An 11 and 9-year-old and a boy and a girl, so that's great.
Yeah, and they get along well. And the challenges for them is being, you know, a mixed child here.
Sure.
And just being, not being Thai and being half American and just kind of figuring out their identity. That's kind of the biggest challenge for them.
But being born in Thailand, that's a plus rather than, I think, being born here and then moving to Thailand. From being I'm going to call it a mixed marriage, but how are they with America? Do they know, are they getting to know American history?
We have an American curriculum, so they have
to.
We don't study American, I mean, there's no Pledge of Allegiance and that
right.
type of thing. But we did, about about 5 or 6 years ago, there was kind of a shift in international school education. A lot of schools where they used U.S. textbooks, and there's been a big shift away from that to go to more global history.
Okay.
So we don't study, like, the U.S. presidents and, you know, too much of U.S. history. We'll more look at global conflicts and global history.
Sure. And
but in high school they do, because actually it's IB. It's they have to, for U.S. entrance to U.S. universities, they have a U.S. program.
Well, that's I mean, that, it's good that they expose the outside world to their culture. You know, where over here, I think it's not as much exposure of foreign cultures as compared to just U.S. history. You know?
Yeah.
And
we visited there, and they're dual citizens. They have the U.S. passport and Thai passport.
Oh, good.
So
good.
They'll have to. Yeah. So that's good. They love. We went back to the States. They love it there. The kids, they want to go back. They want to go back there.
Oh, neat. Well, you ought to bring them back to Saratoga, where you lived for a bit.
Yeah.
You still have family in Michigan?
I do. I have three brothers there, still staying there.
Oh, okay. So you have family when you go there, if you go there anyway.
Yeah.
Now, there was a funny thing, a glitch over there that banks are hard to deal with there.
Oh, when we first got our house, yeah, we were going to buy a house, and there was a law in Thailand that if a Thai was married to a foreigner, they couldn't own property. And the law had changed. After my wife and I married, the law had changed the year prior to that. But we went into banks to buy our house, and no one would even deal with us at all. I mean, we got rejected bank after bank. They would just look at me, and they wouldn't even want to talk to us. And it probably after about 30 banks or something, we finally went into a bank, a branch of one of the same banks that we had been to before, and the manager sat us down, and he got us a loan for a house. But we put down 50%.
Well, that's the way to go around it, you know.
Yeah, and it's good to put down 50%. Looking back, I should have paid the whole thing off right then. But
well, hey, 50% is good. You know.
Yeah.
Before we get into the book, because we can always come back to your life, because I find your life very fascinating. I really do. I mean, you're almost like an Alan Quatermain, you know. I mean, you have so many life experiences that are so, I don't know, it's like reading a book.
I was into the trying new things, I don't know if it was intentional. I just was trying to find my place, you know, and I just would, I was never afraid to take chances and take a risk and go somewhere.
Sure. Well, one of the things before we get into the book, and then I'd like to, after the book, I'd like to get into some family-related information, and then we can talk about, you know, what you're doing as far as probably a new book or what you're doing in writing. You're celebrating this week the New Year, Thai New Year?
Yes, Thai New Year, the Songkran this week. So I'm on a 12-day holiday now.
Oh,
so
you are?
It's been a crazy week. It's the end of the dry season, headed into the rainy season. So there's it's a water festival for the whole week.
And you said you can't stay dry?
You can't stay dry. You got to stay inside. If you go outside, you're going to get hit with water. No matter, you can't plead, you can't say anything. You're going to get nailed with water, and a lot of water if you go outside.
Oh, dear. And it says here that during this time, the people in the north, and now this is their custom, so it you know, to us it sounds terrible. But
some of their custom,
They eat black dogs.
Some do, yeah. Some Northeastern prefer a black dog during this time of year. For some reason.
And you did have a black dog.
Yeah, I still have my black dog.
Okay.
But yeah, last year or the year before, my black dog went missing at this time. And we couldn't find it. And then my wife had told me about that custom. And so I panicked and went outside into our community. And we live in a gated community. And the security told me that, you know, some workers here were chasing our dog. And so our dog was missing for about 6 hours, and I thought they had taken it and eaten it. But eventually I found the dog back in a half-built house in the back of our community, hiding in a house. And she never runs away. So
I'd be hiding, too.
Huh?
I said I'd be hiding, too.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's terrible. Actually, but, you know, the temples here are full of dogs, and recently there's a lot fewer dogs in the streets here because there's a they've been moving a lot of the dogs. Someone's picking up the dogs and selling them in the north towards the northern border.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big kind of outcry to stop that. So.
Well, that's, yeah.
But we don't eat dog in Thailand. There's no. We don't. There's people don't eat dogs here.
Well, I mean, it's like Korea. I mean, you know, some do because it's an old tradition. You know.
Right.
And they're probably getting away from that a little bit. You know, more than they did 100 years ago or whatever. One of the things with Plang Song and some of the reviews on, that I read from, you know, newspapers, India, and you have so many reviews on the book and the internet and online, is that, and this again is, like I said, you should write a book about yourself because your life is so fascinating. But one of the things in that you put into your book are highlights of your life or things taken from the context of your life that you put into Plang Song. And you know, where did you come up with the idea for Plang Song?
Oh, for the book.
Yes.
Well, originally, I had about 8 years ago, I came up with a title, and I had a student, and her name was Plang, in my class, and she was really shy and quiet. And right then I thought, you know, I liked Plang in Thai means song. And I thought, oh, Plang Song, and I loved the title. And at that time I thought, you know, I'm going to write this book called Plang Song about a girl who's kind of shy and whose parents are gone. And it turned out that Plang herself, that student, the book is not about her family, but her parents were gone a lot. And I remember Plang wasn't doing her homework, and I had said to her one day, I want to see your mother. You get your mother in here. Why aren't you doing your work? And right after that, I saw one of my colleagues, and I said, this Plang isn't doing her work. And my colleague said, well, don't you know who her parents are? And I said, no. And they said, well, her mother's Namthida. She's this very famous singer in Thailand, and she comes from this real powerful family. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, what have I done to speak with her like that? And her mother used to come in the morning to drop her off to school, and she was just this average-looking person. I mean, I didn't take any notice of her. But when she came to see me, she did herself up, and you could see what a great entertainer. I mean, she could turn on that light, and she walked into the room and had such a presence about her that I was I was like speechless and blown away.
Wow.
But she's a great person. So she's not like Plang's mother in the book, but Namthida's a wonderful, wonderful lady.
Right. And did she take your advice or, you know, the things you had to say about Plang, did she take them in stride?
Oh yeah, she was
agree
great.
With you. Yeah.
She's a great mom, very supportive, and she was singing then. I mean, she had a tour or something. She was doing songs, and so she was busy. But she was great. She was just a great person.
That's neat. Now, as we said, Plang Song, the book is not about her parents, but one of the things that is predominant in the book is the monsoons that you have over there, that and that is an important part of that book too. I think you know, when I read it, that's one of the things that where in the middle of the book, or maybe in the second, third, plays a predominant part in the story. And did you took that from you know the weather and what happens over there?
Yeah, a little bit. I had started the story, and it was actually the original story was going to be a completely different story. It was going to be a kind of a love story with Plang and the other character, Billy. And then as I got into the book, there was these images we were getting on TV and the internet about all the rains that had come and the prediction that Bangkok was going to flood, which it hadn't flooded in like 50 years. But my area, which is Kwong Samwa, they had said, you know, it's going to be under 2 meters of water. And so at that time, I stopped writing the book, and I packed up my wife refused to leave the house. And so I said, well, I'm taking the kids out of here because I can't take a chance. And so she stayed, and I took the kids away to the beach for a few days to see to see what happened, because we were being told, you know, the water is going to come any day. So we went away for about 3 days, but I spent a lot of money. And I called my wife, and she said, well, the water's only about 2 or 3 inches now. It's no problem. So we eventually drove back home to stay at our house again.
And everything was okay?
But no, then we got back, and the images, you know, they had different elevation maps, and they said, you know, this area, we were declared an evacuation zone.
Oh,
and
okay.
Some places around my house were under a lot of water, and they moved in Army trucks, a huge Army trucks, like these huge wheels, like 12 feet high, and they'd pull people out of these communities and take them out. So they advised everyone in my area to evacuate the area. But we eventually went away again to a hotel, and then we could still get back into our area. There's about a foot of water. I got my car in. But after that, I decided that I would just stay in our house because of the cost of staying at a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And they did have evacuation centers that were open, but, you know, it's a little bit different than the United States because, you know, these evacuation centers are probably, you know, they're filled with people who come from really poor backgrounds.
Sure.
And I felt like if I was going to get my kids out of here, we'd get on an one of these big Army trucks, evacuate ourselves, and get in a taxi and go down to the beach, and I just, you know, if I needed to, put the bill on a credit card. But I wasn't going to go to an evacuation center.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I don't blame you there. And there's some, like you said, there's so many people that that kind of is contrary to what you prefer. You don't prefer.
Yeah,
a lot
and
of people.
We live in air. My kids grew up in air conditioning. I mean, it's really hot here. I can't sleep at night here without air conditioning.
Really,
it's just,
like
it's
a humid. Tropical.
It's like, you know, yeah, you take Saratoga, the worst day in the summer. It's like that every day, hot and very humid.
Well, it's very tropical in Thailand,
yeah,
correct?
Very much so.
Yeah. Now, one of the important things that I think comes from your childhood, which is a great tool for writers, is to keep a diary or a journal.
Yeah.
And your reason for that is because
yeah, I mean, I just think real life situations provide the best stories for creating fiction.
Sure. And I think, but you know, I mean, if you didn't have that journal and you tried to remember back years to things that happened, you get somewhat of a cloudy remembrance of it. But by keeping a journal, you can go and pick out things that happened, and they're clear in your mind, and that probably can help you write the story a little more fluidly.
Yeah, definitely.
Bring in other things that happen, and one of the things that we talked about last time is that good writers revise and edit.
Right.
And did you do a lot of revising and editing of the book?
Yeah, I wrote the first draft of the book in about 3 months, 3 to 4 months. That was 3 to 4 hours a night. And then I spent about 6 or 7 months revising, and that was about 3 hours a night. And
wow.
I reread that story, I'd say, well over 100 times. And my wife had bought a new printer, and I broke her printer because I had printed the book. So I printed over and over. I prefer to read a hard copy.
Sure.
And I had over and over. I mean, I went sentence by sentence. I went over that story because I wanted to keep the language really simple, so kids could read it, but yet still have it kind of an interesting, complex story.
Sure. Now, did you, as you were writing this, did you share this with your students?
Yeah, I would bring in 2 to 3 pages every day and read the story to them. You know, in the original story, a lot of things. You know, the first draft, Plang had lost part of her ear, all these crazy, and I kind of went off. Sometimes I'd get off the storyline. The students would bring me back, and they'd tell me, you know, edit this and take this out. And so I think that's why it really captures a good a girl's voice. I just visited 3 schools here as a guest author in Thailand, and the kids love that story. They just eat that story up.
Well, I can see why.
Yeah, it's good. I'm happy to just write something for, write something for children that they like.
Sure. And obviously, so you said they gave you some ideas or they vocalized what about the book to you? when you
used to bring and we would use real life classroom situations, like you were just saying, keep a journal, and actually some of the dialogue and like the girl getting busted with the iPhone in class really happened. Mm-hmm. The ice cream party really happened. So I added these real events into the book to show the students how you can take a real life situation, twist it and turn it, and create it into fiction.
Now, do you encourage your students to keep a diary or journal?
Yeah, I do. You know, I used to require my students to keep a diary and write a page a night, but I think it was a bit cumbersome for some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I could require that for homework, definitely. You know, and I try to encourage kids to write a page a day. It's just that sometimes I think if you have kids with some learning disabilities or who find writing difficult, it can be really hard for them.
Oh, sure. But, you know, you should do what your father did. You tell them to write about something that they want to write about.
I let them write. I let them write. And they can write about whatever they want, and I don't criticize. You know, a lot of kids get into these zombie stories now, and I just let them go with it.
Sure.
As long as they're writing.
Well, it's creative at this age, and who knows what it'll be when they get older. In writing a book, we had discussed that you should keep it simple.
Yeah.
Right? And limit the number of characters. And
for me, I would limit the number of characters. I mean, I see young writers trying to have like 10 characters in a story.
Okay.
And it's just so hard to develop 10 characters and then have them relate to each other effectively and clearly in a story and without losing the reader. You know, I always tell, you know, my students that, look, when you get older, believe it or not, you'll want to go home and you'll want to read for enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when I go home and read for enjoyment, I don't want to be stressed out when I'm reading a book. I want to read something that flows smoothly and it's easy to read.
Oh, sure.
And it's enjoyable.
Well, one of my favorite authors is, and I don't know if you've ever heard of him, Clive Cussler.
No.
And he writes these adventure books with...
oh, good. Let me look him up then.
Yeah, you should. Clive Cussler. He's a wonderful writer. I mean, he's written so many books but one of the things about his books, he starts out with something that happened 200 years ago, or depending on what the book's about. And maybe 7 or 8 pages, right? Then he comes to the present day. And he's got a cast of they're either government officials like NUMA, where they're underwater agency, but there's only four or five people in that. Or there's other books where he has a couple that go out and help do some things or go on adventures. But one of the things he does, he'll tie in like the main character or characters with the two people. Then I call it the bad people, okay, the bad side. And, you know, he goes back between the two or three different things, but it ties in all together all the time so that you don't get frustrated when you're reading it. And when you're done with the book, you say, I can't be done already because, I mean, the endings are great, but the books just flow so nicely. You ought to look him up. Clive Cussler.
Yeah, I'll read his stuff.
And
I think that's why you focus on telling a story and being clear, right? It's really difficult to write a very clear, simple story that's easy to read. That's the challenge.
Oh, it's got to be. It's got to be. And you don't want to get too, like you said, you don't want to get too detailed with a lot of characters and a lot of plots and subplots.
And descriptions. I think a lot of people fall into a lot of descriptive detail, and that you can easily lose your reader with that.
Oh, I do. I mean, I'll just stop reading the book. There's too many good books out there that you don't have to challenge every night in reading, you know. And so I don't know. But when you were... revising and editing, what was the hardest part of playing song that you had to adjust or that you felt that you had to maybe recreate? Was there any part of that story that really was tough for you to make flow with the, you know, how that it came out in such a good book now?
I think for me it's this always like the paragraph transitions. And going from one paragraph to the next and keeping the flow going in the book.
Okay, so that's
that was the most
Go ahead.
That was hard. But, so many magical things happened with that. And for me, during that time when I wrote the book, I actually went on a really rigid vegan diet. And I was really, really thin. And I wasn't eating much. And I just got in a really good groove of writing at that time, which I wish I could get back and do that all over again. But, yeah, it was kind of like this magical time. You know, so many magical things happened with that book, even with the review I had shared with you when I wrote to you about The Nation, when I sent the book to the book reviewer, and he wasn't going to review the book, and he just threw the book on the table.
Right.
And then his granddaughter picked it up and read it and said, "Oh, Grandpa, you got to write about this book." And, you know, that's what started the whole thing.
Well, that's, I mean, I know in one review, it puts it into the genre of the Harry Potter books and Narnia and the Princess Diary series and the Hunger Game trilogy. And I think because of that is that the book can be easily read by children and young adults. And that those are very hard books to come by. I mean, you know, these and the writers of those books are special people because they can do that. I mean, J.K. Rowling from, you know, with the Harry Potter books, I mean, all her books are very easily could flow. And I think, like you said, that's the important thing to do is to flow. And I'm sure they're not easy to write, don't get me wrong. But now, do you see any sequel to Playing Song?
That's the first question I get when I visit these schools is all the kids say, when's Playing Song 2 coming out? But I don't think I'll write it because the Playing Song has done so well, and it's just I don't think I can. I don't want to spoil it with trying to recreate that.
Yeah.
Unless it comes out of me, I just feel like I want to let it stand on its own and just leave it and move on to something else.
Well, it's like a lot of movie sequels. Usually, they're not as good as the first movie.
Yeah.
Because
I feel like if I wrote, I'd just be writing it for the sake of a sequel, I wouldn't be really writing it because that's what I want to write.
Well, now, what's next on the horizon for you? Do you have anything in the works or anything?
Well, yeah, I'm working on a book called Memories of Gaslight, and so and right now it's more directed towards adult readers. But I think after seeing the reaction of the kids read my book, this last Playing Song, I'm going to probably go back and rework the book to make it appealing to young readers as well.
Well, that's interesting. We'll have to notify me when you get the book done.
Yeah, probably 2 years. I'm taking some time off now. I'm going to take 3 or 4 months off and rest here and then get back to work. But, probably a couple years.
Yeah.
We spend so much time. And, I mean, this year has been, I've had a great year with so many things happening. But it's kind of like I think it's going to come to an end. Then I got to go back and work for 2 more years and then maybe have a little, hopefully another nice little run.
Well, that's great. I think you need to take some time off to get some fresh ideas and clear
for
your mind.
And, you know, I have to get the voice of Playing out of me, and she's finally, I think, leaving me where when I sit down to write, I still have that same character in me.
Sure.
And so I have to, it's difficult to completely get rid of that.
Well, Patrick, believe it or not, we're down to 30 seconds.
Wow, that was fast.
Yes,
I thought maybe we wouldn't make the full hour, but man, it's over already.
It's over already. So what I want from you is where can someone order the Playing Song?
Well, Playing Song in Thailand is in paperback at all major bookstores here, but in the U.S. it's only in digital format on anywhere online, Amazon or any major bookstore.
Well, listen, it was great talking to you again, and maybe we can get together sometime in the
future. In Thailand, you're coming, right?
Yeah, I'll be there in Thailand. I'll let you know. All right. Well, listen, we'll talk to you soon, I hope, or email you anyway. We'll keep in touch, and you have a good holiday over there.
Good night.